I don't know.
Say it with me. I don't know.
Good God, it is liberating. I am a towering mountain of ignorance. I don't know.
We're taught to believe that everything has a reason.
And so we observe the world, we see what happened, and then we define the thing that happened as the reason the thing happened. But I think a lot of the time we end up mixing up thinking something with knowing something. This is why it can be so impossible to talk about certain topics with certain people. They've tied those suppositions to themselves so tightly with knots of narrative and constructed reality and values that there's just no untying it. And maybe unsurprisingly, in those situations, the best course of action is just to be friends. Maybe even ask them about that thing that they've created, because to them, it's immensely valuable. The world as we perceive it, as we've built it inside of ourselves, is a lie that we tell to ourselves, not out of deception, but out of necessity. We have no other choice. We simply cannot understand the world as it is, and so we construct. But sometimes I just have to tell myself the thing that is definitely true, the truest thing I can say, which is that I don't know.
This is the Everyone's Agnostic Podcast with Bob Pondillo and Cass Midgley.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Cass Midgley. This is the weekend of June 6th, 2015. Bob and I have taken some time off to do some fun things with family and friends, so I'm pulling out of the archives. Back on April 4th, I taped a few random interviews at the American Atheist Convention in Memphis, so today I'm posting a few selections from that experience. The first is a 9-minute interview with Dave Kong. Kong was personal friends with Madeline Murray O'Hare, the founder of American Atheist, and he has witnessed the movement from the beginning. And for those who may have little exposure to Madeline, I've posted an 11-minute excerpt from a speech she gave at the 1972 convention, 10 years after she founded the movement. Next is a 6-minute interview with comedian Keith Lowell Jensen, who performed a stand-up routine at the conference. I've also tacked on a 3-minute excerpt of a bit he performed there. Keith has his own podcast called It's Funny Because, available on iTunes and Facebook. Lastly, I play a fascinating talk given by Dr. Jennifer Michael Hecht called Poetic Atheism. She wrote a book that changed my life called Stay, A History of Suicide and the Arguments Against It. She argues that to say there is no meaning in life or that we have to make our own seems misguided, and that meaning has always been a part of community and culture. We need not invent it. She earned her PhD from Columbia University in the history of science and European culture. She's also the author of a book called Doubt, A History, The Great Doubters and Their Legacy of Innovation from Socrates and Jesus to Thomas Jefferson. Also another book, The Happiness Myth, The Historical Antidote to What Isn't Working Today. I think you're going to enjoy Dr. Hecht's talk and overall the hodgepodge of my experience from American Atheist Convention. Today's beautiful segue music is performed by friend of the show, Nikolai Gablishin. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and most podcast platforms. If you're feeling grateful for our podcast, Patreon.com is like a tip jar for our work. That's Patreon.com/EA Podcast. I hope your life is enhanced by this episode. Thanks for listening, and be a yes-sayer to what is. What's your name?
Hi, my name's Dave Kong.
Kong?
Kong, K-O-N-G, like a big gorilla.
King Kong?
Yes.
I'm Cass.
Hey, nice to meet you.
Good to meet you. So you were raised religious, but...
Raised in the Episcopalian church, but I always suspected something because my dad never went to church except on Easter and Christmas.
Right.
So, and my mom went to church, but we used to go to midnight mass, and she'd come up with some excuse to go to the bathroom with me, and we'd just hang out in the bathroom and pretty much miss the sermon.
So neither one of them are very serious.
Neither one of them seemed to be very, very serious about it, which had never really occurred to me until later in life. And then when I was about 8, And I know most people would say, well, this is a really foolish reason, but I'd come across the book Chariots of the Gods.
Okay.
And I had read that, and I said, well, I don't necessarily believe the whole alien thing, but what he's basically saying that if these stories in the Bible actually happened, there had to be some sort of scientific basis for it.
All right.
So I very quickly said, well, if that's the case, then there really are no gods.
Yeah.
And so I told that to my mom. At the time, she told me, oh, no, you're wrong. You're very, very wrong.
At 8 years old.
And so I just kind of shrugged it off and didn't really give it too much thought, continued to go to church with her. And then when I was 15, I formed an atheist rock band.
Okay.
And so, of course, we're working on my band, and one night my mom comes up to me and says, you know, I've been thinking about it, and you're right. And she said, there is no God. And so we scored one for mom. That was cool.
Yeah, very much.
And then my band at one point, I grew up in Des Moines, Iowa.
Okay.
And we finally had a big gig at Adventureland theme park. And so we did advertising with these flyers about the band and didn't really say anything about the anti-religion. Well, we did have a joke at the bottom that said distributors of religious publications will be bodily evicted. You know, clearly a joke. It caused an uproar. I could not believe
it. Just that little subject.
That little thing. Suddenly, parents started calling my mom. Churches started calling my mom. The principals of schools were calling my mom.
Tell me again what it said.
It said distributors of religious publications
so
would be bodily evicted.
People giving out
tracts.
Would be bodily removed.
So parents were calling my mom. The sheriff's department called my mom, and she just told him I agree with my son, piss off, and hung up. And finally, Adventureland said, okay, well, this is too hot to handle. Here's your money back. And we just said, oh, we were clearly on to something. Let's go to California.
Yeah, you would have thought that they would like, you know, sometimes the controversy brings out more people sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is Iowa in, 1979 or something like that. They were hardly ready for it.
Even now, Iowa was probably pretty conservative.
And even then, we were not.
It was a joke.
Yeah, and we didn't consider ourselves an atheist band. We just we do our little anti-religious thing, and it's just fun. It's boys will be boys. It's good, clean fun. What's the harm in it?
Yeah.
And then we moved out to California and started playing, and suddenly, it's in the mid-80s at this point, and then suddenly we're at these gigs, and people are going, Hail Satan, and giving us the devil horn signs, and we were just embarrassed. We're not into that, nor do we want to be associated with that.
Yeah.
And so we just declared ourselves an atheist band.
Yeah.
And before I'd left Des Moines, we'd had the fortune to see Madeline O'Hare speak at Drake University, a rather famous speech that she gave.
Uh-huh.
And so when I was in California, I finally contacted her and said, hey, my band's an atheist band. Could we sign up under the family plan for American atheists? And she was fine. She said, yeah, go ahead. And we signed up. So we were proud card-carrying American atheist members.
What year was that?
It was, it had to be 80...
Wow. So you've been a part of this for a long time.
Oh, absolutely.
You've probably been to several of these conferences. This is my first conference.
Oh, well, that's it. I went to a conference in 88 to promote our upcoming album, and it was in Minneapolis, and Madeline was really good. She'd put in a couple notices about our band in her newsletter from time to time, and I went to the convention for the first time, and everybody knew who I was. Oh, you're that guy in that band.
Wow. Was Madeline one of the founders of it?
Oh, she was definitely the founder of American Atheists.
See, I didn't realize that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, she was she was a firebrand. You talk about the firebrands we have now. She was a firebrand.
Yeah, I've watched some old YouTubes of her.
Oh, yeah. She was incredible.
So, I guess my question is, you've watched it evolve over the years.
I have. I absolutely have.
What's different? What's good? What's bad? How's it improved?
It's exploded. Are you kidding?
The numbers.
Well, right before Madeline disappeared, she put me on the national board. So I was on the national board for 13, 19. Lost track of the years at this point. But then I retired slightly before Dave Silverman became president. I've just watched everything just grow and explode. I've seen our visibility within the general culture just improve. You know, there's atheist characters on TV all the time. In fact, if anything, they mock the religious. And it's just really...
Since there might be a grassroots movement, like there's something changing, even in America.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And part of it, I must say, was the agreement of all the various atheist and free thought groups to cooperate.
Yeah.
Because when I started out, they weren't cooperating.
Right.
And in California, we with Bobby Kirkhart, we were one of the first states to say, hey, we really have to work on these things together, or we're gonna all be screwed.
Yeah, maybe Jesus was right. A house divided against itself will not stand.
I'm sure you could quote other people with similar quotes, but
So, you still have rock and roll hair.
I still have rock and roll.
Are you still a musician?
The band folded, the hair didn't.
Okay. So what have you been doing since? What do you do for a living?
For a living, I work for a law firm.
Okay.
I do computer work for a law firm.
So you're like their tech guy?
I'm the tech guy, yeah. I'm it. I'm IT.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, Is it usually, I guess, what do we got, about 750 people here?
That's what I've heard, something like that, yeah. Yes.
Is that pretty normal in the last few years, or does it get bigger every year?
It varies. You know, after the Reason Rally, we had a huge convention in D.C., the next one was pretty big. This one's just a little bit smaller, but you know, they come up, wax and wane. You know?
Two steps forward and one step back.
Right, yeah. I mean, when we first started doing conventions after Madeline had disappeared, we were like clocking at like 200, 300 people, so this is definitely an improvement.
Yeah,
and just frankly, the local grassroots activism.
Yeah,
it's just amazing. I mean, that certainly wasn't around.
I think you're right. I think you're onto something, that we're getting better at organizing.
Mm-hmm. But I also really agreed with J.T. Eberhardt's speech last night, where he was saying that we're getting larger as a movement. We can't let various philosophical differences suddenly split us apart.
Yeah,
and that's
a good point.
That would definitely be our downfall.
Which is what has happened to religion, right? Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. it's like, well, do you immerse in baptism or do you sprinkle? Mm-hmm. Do you speak in tongues or do you not? I mean, they found 1,000 reasons to split over mm-hmm. them, and they end up being very splintered. But yeah, so if we can just say, look, we just want. What do you think of the main things? Separation of church and state? I mean, what are the main platforms that American atheists...
American atheists has always stood on the platform of complete and absolute separation of church and state, and that was always their main thrust, and then also the work to protect and enforce atheist civil rights.
Yeah. Keep the nativity scene off the public lawn.
Yes, yes, yeah. And, you know, and some people say, oh, that's just arguing over petty stuff, but, you know, symbolism is important. That's why it's there.
Well, the Constitution's important.
Yeah, it? Yeah, exactly, yes.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
Hey, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, man.
So, that's my talk with Dave Kong. He's an energetic guy. He was a lot of fun to talk to, really fast. I had seen him the night before. They had a little costume party, and he was fully painted in gold paint. And I don't know if he was... I really don't know what character he was supposed to be, but he was a lot of fun to talk to. I thought it was interesting that he questioned God at 8 years old and never looked back. But this was his 27th conference to attend, and he's been on the board of American Atheists for over 20 years. He's no longer on the board, but he served for over 20 years. Just an interesting talk. Next up, I'm going to play a clip from Madeline Murray O'Hare talk she gave in 1972 at the American Atheist Conference. She surveys different types of atheists. She doesn't like atheists at all, is how she starts out. She resents atheists being called negative. She breaks down the four... Well, let's see, how many types here? Several types of atheists. Primitive, which is just kind of starting out. Philosophical, which are kind of brainiacs. Practical. Hateful. She doesn't like hateful atheists. Fanatical atheists she doesn't like. And lastly, what she calls Maslowian, which I have to think means self-actualized or something. But... she ends the talk with, or at least this portion of the talk, with my favorite poem, For Whom the Bell Tolls by John Donne. So here's Madeline Murray O'Hare, 1972.
I'm asked to speak to you tonight on the question, is atheism the religion of the future? No, that ends that speech. Why atheism won't be the religion of the future is a subject that's very dear to me, and we need only to consider the atheist to discover the answer. And that's what I am here to do tonight, consider the atheist. I don't like atheists very much, if at all. This is highly unusual, given that I am their principal and most articulate spokesman in America. And what brought this situation about, and why they cannot be the messiahs in our culture, is the subject matter of my discussion this evening. Since the prefix a, in a word of Greek derivation, gives a negative sense to that word, an atheist is simply a person who is not theistic, whatever theistic means. And I recognize, and I'm sure you recognize, what Webster has to say and it's always important to make a reference back, that theism is a belief in the existence of God or gods, especially belief in the existence of one God viewed as the creative source of man, whatever creation means to the astronomers or physicists or to you or to me, as the creative source of man and the world, who, not which, but who, transcends yet is immanent. Now, I don't know what transcends means. I do not know what immanent means. And for that matter, I do not know what eternal means or create means or transmigration or grace or prayer or God. And I don't think anybody else in the world knows. These are nonsense words which have special esoteric nonsense meanings to theistic idiots of all brands. Now, an atheist is a person who simply does not accept that view, the view of theism, as I said, whatever it is, and properly stands in opposition to it, because A, used as a prefix, is a privative and negates a word. Now, many people say that atheists are negative because of their appellation. But the prefix in gives a negative sense to a word too, as in independence. And isn't that a negative word? It simply means free of dependency. And independence is a treasured word in American culture, as someday the word atheist will be. To use a term of negative derivation does not mean that the philosophy of living, the Weltanschauung, flowing from it, is in any sense negative. Only the most uneducated would have so little respect for language as to make such a gross supposition. But everything depends on what one means. Let's look at atheists. Known according to the degree of guts they possess, also as agnostics, ethical culturists, humanists, free thinkers, objectivists, secularists, rationalists, iconoclasts, and God alone knows how many other names to hide what they are. But tonight I'm going to call them all atheists because fundamentally they are against theism. There are primitive atheists, philosophic atheists, and practical atheists, and I have been all three. There are also hate-ridden atheists who usually convert from Catholicism, fanatical atheists who usually convert from Jehovah's Witnesses, and the primitive atheists I meet everywhere in great numbers today, usually on campus. A primitive atheist is one who comes of intellectual age, does a double take at Christianity, finds it to be incredible, as any thinking person would, and announces, "I don't believe all that crap," and lets it go at that. These people usually join the Unitarian Church or the Ethical Culture Society and live happily ever after with substituted dogmas, creeds, and routines to fill a gap they imagine was left in their lives. They float around in a small esoteric group which plays the game of discussion in private, specifically the game of we exceptional few and our superior philosophy. The philosophic atheist does a triple take of Christianity and gets hopelessly bogged down in reading Bible, King James, Standard, Revised, Renewed, Reedited, Reinterpreted, and then he turns to the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Torahs, the Book of Mormon, Science of Life, Awaspi, Urantia, I Ching, and other holy books, all of which are trash. He knows the teleological argument for God, or the ontological argument, or the epistemological argument, or the pragmatic or the moral argument, and how to refute them all in excess. He delights in a two-hour discussion of Pascal's choice, and he can use up hours of priceless living time analyzing all of the religious theories, history, diverse theologies. These people have been 10 years in the American Humanist Association, and they live happily ever after, deeply immersed in obscurism, reading in depth the genteel, erudite, and completely worthless articles in the journal of that society. They play the game of beating ideas to death with words, and they usually flaunt PhDs. I need to delineate the other kind of atheist, too, the one who has a hatred reaction to it all. He can recite an extraordinary number of incidents where priests were discovered to be living carnally with their housekeepers. Or he gleefully collects news items where ministers appropriated $15.73 from the roofing fund. Or where ministers were named as correspondents in divorce cases. Or where a young choir boy accused the male director of indecent advances. All of these people belong to the Friendship Liberal League. This type of atheist never gets beyond his hatred, and usually this atheist has a trauma conversion to atheism and not an intellectual one, and he can well have a trauma conversion back to theism and proliferate, these atheists do, through every other category of atheist. Then there is the sectarian atheist, who flourishes only in bitter internecine warfare in the atheist groups and in factional strife therein about who is the better atheist. And they all belong to the American Rationalist Association, and a great number of them belong to the United Secularists of America. Then there is another atheist, a Maslowian type, who just has a natural human thrust to what is healthy and natural in life. His is a gut reaction as well as an intellectual one. He has a way of life and underlying basic positivism. He is grounded in life and its natural rules. He has a freewheeling, open-ended philosophy. His emphasis is on the worth of the individual, his human dignity, his intelligence, his ability to order his own life, his ability to enjoy the emotions with which he is endowed. And his emphasis is on reason, life experience, and common sense. His life, this atheist, is unadorned with creeds, dogmas, and rituals. He does not feel that he is a part of a chosen people, but only a part of mankind. He knows no sacrificial redemptions, he bends no knees, and he bows no head. He is as negative as Columbus, who denied the flat earth. He is as destructive as was Galileo, who saw the earth as a part of a whole. He is as anti as a physician curing a disease. He is interested in here and now, not in fantasy, and he sees religion, theism, as simply being irrelevant to human life. He has no negative, emotion-laden reaction to religion simply because that isn't worth his time. And I am here tonight, I am certain, with this type of atheist predominant in this audience. Then there is the atheist who realizes finally that every aspect of living depends on the total living of all mankind. He recognizes the need of a better cultural philosophic base, and he looks at the old, old poem with new eyes and recognizes it as a new truth. And you know it all. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee.
All right, so there's Madeline Murray O'Hare, and I hope you enjoyed that. Fascinating woman, and somebody needs to make a movie out of her life. She was brutally murdered, and that's part of her story. And up next is Keith Lowell Jensen, the comedian that spoke at American Atheist Convention. So during his comedy routine at the convention, he mentioned something about his wife never having been religious, and he himself was raised religious, and so there's this difference that they run into sometimes, and I thought it was a lot like Bob and I as far as the way our relationship has formed. And then we talk a little bit about the fine-tuning argument near the end. But overall, he's a funny guy, great guy, and recommend his podcast called It's Funny Because, available on iTunes. So here's my interview with Keith Lowell Jensen, followed by an excerpt from a comedy bit that he did during his routine at the convention. Enjoy.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely love it.
So, I'm Cass.
Keith.
Keith Lowell Jensen.
That's me.
So, your wife raised completely atheist, no energy around it.
No, not quite.
Okay.
But her mom was religious, but she just, and her father wasn't. And she just followed
her
father's
route.
Yeah, she never.
So, she never drank the Kool-Aid. It never was this energy, you know, never was this.
At no point did she believe.
Right. So, when the Jehovah's Witnesses come to the door, there's just like, no. We're an atheist family, and she can be real sweet about it. You have this energy around it because you're still.
I exaggerate that on
well,
stage,
sure,
that
absolutely.
Chip on my shoulder, which
yeah.
I think seeing my wife interact with people has
yeah.
sort of influenced me to temper that.
Yeah.
You know, it's more when I was a young atheist that I think I was more kind of in your face and did have that chip on
so
my shoulder.
So some of that energy, I don't know for me, because I was Christian, and then there's a little bit of shame involved for me, because it was like when it finally did dawn on me that there was no Adam and Eve.
Right.
And then it just all came crumbling down. I was pissed.
Yeah,
I felt
yeah.
like I'd been lied to. And I felt like how gullible I was for well into my 30s. How embarrassing is that?
Who did you feel lied to?
Well, that's the thing, is there's no blame game going on. I mean, my mom and dad, you know, the church or whatever, but here we are, and that's where I find myself, is we're in a bizarro world.
Yeah.
Because we're still, like 80% of Americans or whatever, a third of the human population considers themselves Christians, the biggest
right.
religion in the world.
But it's,
and yet, here we are, or at least I am, saying, it didn't happen.
I think that there are liars out there who
yeah.
are just exploiting
charlatans.
It. Yeah, but for the most part, I think the people in my life sincerely believed. And so I didn't
yeah.
have that anger as much as a defensiveness,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then and initially a great depression. That whole, like, well, what is the meaning then?
There you go. The bedrock you know. Falls out.
Yeah.
How now shall I live? And
right.
That's the learning curve for me.
Yeah, yeah.
It was about 9 years to where, and it was stair step, because, you know, I think maybe you made reference to this, but I know for some, you can just become, you go from Bundy to progressive to liberal to Deepak Chopra. You know,
right.
there's the woo-woo. You hang on to this new age stuff or deism or something, and then for me, eventually, it all just disintegrated.
Yeah.
To where we're just almost, you know, cellular beings that are,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
just here. And it's crazy that we're here. It seems, I mean, even Hitchens would use the word miraculous sometimes as
right.
far as, this is crazy. I mean, when you think about evolution, what are the odds that the oxygen level and the temperature and everything was just right for these cells to... But anyway, it's the mind yeah. fuck of all that.
And I'm no scientist, but that thinking still baffles me, because I don't think that the oxygen and the temperature and everything were right for these cells. I think
okay.
that had the temperature and the oxygen level been different,
different
we
creatures.
Might have evolved differently.
Yeah,
we're so convinced that conditions were just right here, and then we did find a life form in, is it Mono Lake? That,
I don't know.
It's an exception to every other organism.
Okay.
Just found within the last couple of years, because it evolved under a different set of conditions.
Okay.
And I think it's arsenic that it actually utilizes within its system.
That's a good point, because without broadening
those options. What is it, the argument that that complexity or something about to where just like, you know, it goes, theists ends up using it for an argument for theism.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's so improbable that it had to be, it's so exact.
Right, because things don't get more complex, they break down.
Yeah, anyway. I don't know how much you've gotten into, I don't get into the debate side of it so much, but.
Sometimes I do when I need to write jokes, you know, because I'll come up with inspiration for funny stuff
when
I'm debating with people. Yes and no. I mean, this is the main way that I make my living, but I hang on to a job working for a friend of mine in town for stability.
What town?
In Sacramento, California.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I'm overly risk averse. You know, I had periods in my life where I grew up poor.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I have recently been, I've kind of become a junkie for Mark Maron's show or Pete Holmes' show where they're interviewing comedians. So I'm trying,
right.
I kind of feel like I'm getting inside the head.
Check out mine. It's called It's Funny Because.
I will.
And we talk to comedians about method and about sort of what's behind
fantastic.
The jokes.
Fantastic. So let me write that down. What's it called?
It's Funny Because.
It's Funny Because.
And it's me and Johnny Taylor, another great comedian.
Okay.
Who's also an atheist.
Well, the thing is I work... in Nashville, but I live in Murfreesboro. It's about an hour commute, one way.
Right.
And so what saved my life from just like hating everyone else on this road?
Podcast.
It's podcast.
Yeah.
And so, man, I definitely will. I definitely will. Well, thanks for talking
cool.
to me.
Yeah, good talking to you.
Yeah,
good to meet you.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen this tattoo going around on the interwebs? This dude got a tattoo on his bicep right there on his big old dog work out bicep. He got a tattoo that says, "Thou shalt not lie with a man as one lies with a woman. It is an abomination." Which means snowmen really dig it. I just finished school. But then it's got the attribution, Leviticus. And the reason people are passing it around is that the attribution's fucking funny. Because Leviticus is the book of the Bible that says, don't get a tattoo, you douchebag. I'm paraphrasing, but that shit's in there. You can look it up. So, that's what people pass it around, but what I find really funny about it is just the wording, thou shalt not lie with a man as one lie with a woman. I don't think that really says don't be gay. Like, that just sounds like advice on positions, doesn't it? Like, good advice. Bible's like, well, hang on. Decide you want to fuck a dude. And you just go jumping right into missionary position. You might end up frustrated. Possibly even injured. You gotta get the legs up a little higher. And I'm sorry if I got too graphic at the end there for you. I had to put that in, though, because I had a lot of gay friends, and they were coming up to me after shows going like, hey, dude, we can do it missionary position, all right? And then me, I'd always answer with, prove it. And I would get weird, and I gotta sleep sometime. So I end that shit. But obviously that's not what this dude meant to get tattooed on his arm. That's not what he's expressing. What he's expressing is don't fuck dudes. That's right there on his bicep, don't fuck dudes. That's what he had to say to the world. And that's a weird sentiment when you're expressing a part of your internal self externally in a way that's permanent and sharing it with the world. What he chose was don't fuck dudes? I mean, to me, that begs the question, how shitty is this guy's memory? Because mine's fucking awful. And I almost never forget not to fuck dudes. I'm not going all memento on my ass or anything. I just don't fuck them. That's that easy. Thank you guys so much.
So that was Keith Lowell Jensen, funny guy, good guy. Next is Dr. Jennifer Michael Hecht in a talk that she gave at the American Atheist Convention in April 2015 entitled Poetic Atheism. It's mostly about suicide and why it's important to stay. That's the name of her book. And here's Jennifer Michael Hecht.
I love being here. I'm always making this an explicitly secular argument, but it's very nice to be among atheists and be able to just not have to hedge that one. My interest in this subject started because I lost two friends to suicide. we weren't that close anymore. We'd all gotten our PhDs up at Columbia in the 90s, and we'd been good friends then. And after one friend did it, the other one wrote her posthumous afterword to her poetry book. And they were both very successful. Then the other one did it. And somehow that year and a half in between, because I write about atheism, because I write about doubt, it's you almost become an atheist priest. People ask you questions, and as a historian, I have some answers, because I know how a lot of people have lived with either doubt or atheism all over the world throughout history. You know, I know that there's no God. People say you can't know, but I know there's no Superman, because I know when we made him up. And I know when we made up God, and I know when we made up the afterlife, and I know how it's changed in different places and times. The whole idea of agnosticism comes out of ancient skepticism, but it's invented in the late 19th, early 20th century as an idea that you can't prove something to not be there. But you can. You can't prove there are no unicorns, because a goat could just have one. But you can prove there's no Pegasi, because wings would have to be the size of a football field to pick up a horse. So there are things that are patently ridiculous. The earliest doubters, the earliest atheists I found in history, straight out atheists, because in the Psalms, which go back really far, it says the godless this and the godless that, and we just sort of don't notice it. But the ancient Kārvaka in 600 BC, before Buddhism, indeed we think Buddha was influenced by the ancient Kārvaka, they said if souls could exist without bodies, you'd also see mangoes hanging in the air with no tree, but you don't. Every brain, every mind I've ever encountered is gray and smushy. None of it hangs out in the sky. So it's again, as we all know, extraordinary claims need extraordinary proofs. But as a person who sometimes suffers dark times herself, I felt like I had to think this through, that we had to think about what we could do for each other about sadness and about misery. And the idea of surrendering to something, just how, what can we do? And I began to think that the feeling of meaning is sufficient to the definition of meaning. Just as the feeling of love is sufficient to the definition of love, you don't always feel love. But you remember you did, and you remember other people probably are now. And meaning, too, isn't always a feeling we have, but we have felt it. So to say that there is no meaning, and to say that we each have to create our own meaning, seems misguided. I think meaning was always in community and culture, and it is now. We haven't really lost anything. There is no God-shaped hole. What first came to me was the notion that we need each other. That if a suicide causes this much pain and this much suffering, and indeed, people through history have noticed that when one person does it, more people do. Call it cluster, suicidal clusters, or contagion, or social modeling. One leads to more. And that means that if you stay, you're doing a service, and you deserve our gratitude. If you stay for other people, you're doing something. Crying and useless is fine. Crying and useless is a million times better than dead. I'm not speaking at all about end-of-life care, and I have a sort of loose way of defining that by saying if one medical professional or member of your family or your friends thinks maybe you've had enough, whatever it is, okay, you're a different category, and that needs to be adjudicated on its own terms. But if you know that even you in another mood would hate what you're doing, and you know everyone you know will be upset and think it was not the right thing to do, then give yourself a little more time. And the ideas matter. People, their first response to this is always, well, somebody who's feeling that sad doesn't have access to ideas. But it doesn't turn out to be the case. Like, I get mail every day from people saying that either one or the other argument worked for them. The first argument is that you stay for community, and most secular philosophers throughout history have argued this, that we owe each other to stay. Socrates told the students and friends in the room with him where he drank the hemlock, "You may not do this unless you also are condemned to do it by a court of law, because we need each other." The second argument is about your future self. You don't really know who that guy is going to be. Don't kill him. He may know a lot of things you don't know. If you think of what you knew 10 years ago, it can be pretty persuasive. I certainly hear from college kids who are moved most by the friendship argument, the idea that they could hurt their friends. I mean, it's statistically very clear that if you want your niece to make it through her dark night of the soul, you have to make it through yours. An ex-Army Ranger wrote a piece for the Daily Beast saying he'd read the book and that he changed it for him, that if you want your fellow ex-Army Ranger to make it through his stuff, he said, "I guess I have to make it through mine. I have to accept the help people have been trying to give me." Because he didn't want to get help. And I'm certainly not offering this as an alternative to help. Help is great for everybody. I'm a big booster in of talk therapy. I think it's a route to truth. You get to see the world a little bit. You know, look at us. We each have this little skull and these two little viewpoints, and we're trying to see the world. And anytime you can get a little bit of an idea of what your biases are, you become wiser. It's a way of seeing more. The idea that, well, look, if God didn't make up morality, and he didn't, then we did. And I'm very impressed. We don't always hit the mark, but we try. Lots of human beings try to be good. And we feel moral feelings, which you can't explain it away by explaining it away. There's still something very strange and real about being human. Even consciousness is a weirder trick than virgin birth. I mean, if I didn't see it with my own eyes, I'd never believe it. The meat wrote Ode to Joy and Romeo and Juliet? It's really quite extraordinary. It's bizarre. It's the bizarre that's behind religious bizarreness. The most rationalist of people who believe in some notion of God do so often because of consciousness. But I meet weird right where I meet it. I don't make another tertiary level of weird to cover up the weird that I see. So is existence very strange? Oh my, yes. Do I then assume some other strange things from it? Not the best idea to me, either for truth or for help. So I go through history and I look for what people have said about suicide. And what I found, well, I sort of had this hunch before I went into it, it was very much confirmed, that Christianity kind of overdid it in its attack of suicide. I knew that, but I didn't know exactly why. But when you look back, what happens is the ancient world, the Greeks and the Jews is what Christianity is made of. And both of those traditions were not rapidly anti-suicide. Samson asks God to help him have just enough strength to kill the Philistines, but also himself. He says, "I'll die there too." So the Jews are sort of against it, but not always. And the Greeks are more against it than you'd think, but not always. What happens is martyrdom. The emperors had so many Christian martyrs in the early days of Christianity that there were cases where the emperor just said, "If anyone else here wants to die for Christianity, could you please go home and do it yourself?" And people did. But after Constantine makes Christianity legal, it's not the state religion, but he makes it legal, there's no need for martyrdom anymore, to stand up for the religion. And yet it goes on and on and on. And so Christian councils, starting in the 400s, 500s, start saying things like, if you are on a martyr list, if someone was martyred by suicide, but in fact wanted to die, you're off the list. That was the first one. You don't get to really be a martyr. And then they start doing things like burying outside the church cemetery and eventually torturing the corpses. Consistently torturing the corpses. Everyone thought of suicide as a worse crime than murder because you were stealing from God instead of someone else. So when the martyrdom keeps happening centuries after Christianity is no longer, nobody's dying for it by anyone else's hand, that the church makes these draconian laws, including eventually confiscating the estate. So you really hurt your family. A lot of the more subtle Christian thinkers gave the two reasons I gave you, that you shouldn't kill yourself because of community, because you're needed. It's not your job to figure out if you're worthy all the time. Sometimes you have to let the community help you with that. And also, so community and yourself. But they also said God doesn't like it. And that was just too easy a way of saying you mustn't do it. So the Enlightenment kind of went a little too far in the other direction. Obviously, even Voltaire, who tells you not to kill yourself, he has a wonderful line of the person who kills themselves, if they just waited a week, might not have wanted to. So he's thinking sort of practically. But Diderot was very against suicide, wrote a huge diatribe about it in the Encyclopedia. Kant says, when you destroy yourself, you destroy the world. But I was saying Voltaire actually does struggle against these draconian punishments of the church. But it's David Hume who really writes the piece that people think of as giving people the right to suicide. And he's, you know, he says, if a rock is falling on me and I step out of the way, am I disobeying God? When we build houses, there weren't houses when God made the world. But, you know, he's making these arguments that the church has no right. But he definitely is a little flip about it. He's making jokes. And in a way, you're arguing people into the grave. Rousseau is famous for an argument for suicide, but it is answered by a much better argument against. And that's the one that he sort of ends with. So the Enlightenment is by no means uniformly open about suicide. But this argument that the church shouldn't be stopping us made us sort of put it on the roster of rights. But if morality exists at all, it's about not harming people and not harming yourself. Even John Stuart Mill, with utilitarianism, he says the few things you can't do are sell yourself as a slave to someone. You can't give yourself as a slave to someone. You may not use freedom to take away your freedom, Mill says. And for the same reason, you're not free to hurt other people. And he says you're not free to kill yourself. You'd be taking away your own freedom. So it's really the ideas come about in the Enlightenment. They're a little too flip. And then you see them again in the beginning of the 20th century. Sartre, very big on... Every philosopher through history says that you come into the world and then you find out about your meaning. But the meaning's already there. It's in the community. It's in the culture. Sartre is the one who turns it around and says, no, you rise up, because he's an atheist philosopher. And we connect this idea of a kind of harsh world with being a good atheist. Like, we're willing to see what's there. But really, again, it's that God-shaped hole a lot of the time. You know, death is not an abyss. There is no abyss. If you thought that you were going to walk straight, and then you come to a cliff, you got an abyss, right? I invented a little philosophical doodad of the notion of the holding. What if we had never thought of gravity, but we believed that everything was being held down by some god who's looking after us, keeping us and all the stuff from flying out into space? If you realized at some point that that was not the case, you might feel there was an abyss up there, and it might be freaky. Every culture, as it comes out of a religion or a dogma, misses those things and takes it for granted. I mean, in the late kingdom of ancient Egypt, was there some woman who missed the pyramids? Remember, even the afterlife in that world wasn't for everybody. It was at first only for the pharaohs, and then you buy into it if you have money. But it was never for everybody. That's the thing. There have been more people through history who haven't believed in God than who have. And we're told the opposite, but it isn't true. Confucianism has no God. Theravada Buddhism has no God. These are systems of ways of feeling and ways of being with each other. And we know when this Judeo-Christian idea came into being, and it has these attributes. Most people through history have not lived with the idea of an afterlife, and you don't hear them saying through history that they need one or that they miss one. You don't see it. And a good deal of the Bible is written before we have an afterlife. Job is written before there's an afterlife. Ecclesiastes says, why should a man die differently than a dog? If we were the only ones on the planet, you could maybe guess these things, but you look around and we're animals among animals, and we have something very special, which is culture and community. But to assume that there's something, a special situation for us, it doesn't make sense once you're sort of seeing everything. If you really do think you can step on an ant and nothing happens, it begins to be clear that we're organic. But the thing is, you're never going to ask yourself, am I alive or dead, and get the wrong answer. As far as you're concerned, you're always alive. Don't worry about it. Also, life's exhausting. Who wants another one? It's ridiculous. So I've allowed myself to roam on topics because it is early and I didn't sleep well. But I also just wanted to sort of share this point of view, which is what I call it poetic atheism. It's very close to humanism, but I like making a point that we're really talking atheism here. No spirit, no ghost, no nothing. No supernatural. But the poetic part is to say that when we only lean on science we're missing half the patrimony. That most artists and poets are doubters, at least, because why else would you become one? You're trying to figure out the world for yourself. So it's really, you know, you have a few poets who write about God, but most of them don't. Keats knows he's dying, he's already coughing blood, and he's writing about it, when I have fears that I may cease to be. And then the last two lines he says, he goes to the beach, and he goes down to the wide world to think, till love and fame to nothingness do sink. He goes to the beach, not the church. I'll stop there because I want questions. I'll just say, I want it to be clear that there is a way of speaking about meaning and morality without God, because we always have been. Right? The holding wasn't holding us. We were always doing it. And we're doing it now. But the more conscious you are of it, the more beautiful it is. And for community, we're doing what needs to be done, which is show up. It's good to come out of the closet, but you also have to leave the house.
Hi, thanks for being with us. One of the most profoundly sad suicides I know of is David Foster Wallace.
Yeah.
And how for many years he suffered depression that seemed to be untreatable.
David Foster Wallace is a very sad case because he actually was saying that he felt cured. He just didn't like the meds he was on. And so he went off them. And it was very soon after that that he did it. Yeah, it's very tragic. But it also reminds us, most of us think we're going to be happy when we're successful. And it just doesn't work. It doesn't work. What works is trying to be successful. So you work hard and have purpose and you have direction. Sometimes, though, success makes someone feel very guilty for not being happy because we all believe this thing. And so when you see the very successful using drugs to the point of death or killing themselves, you know, it looks like a conundrum, but it's not really. They found out they were still sad, and the rest of us are running towards it the rest of the whole life. So it's, but yeah, with him, it's tough to lose a person like that.
Hey, thank you for talking this morning. I have a couple questions, but I'll pick
one.
Right. Do you choose the terminology killing yourself or committing suicide in lieu of dying by suicide or, you know, pathologizing suicide to the point of making suicide a disease and thinking of it psychiatrically,
right.
And why?
That's a great question. I think that, well, we can sort of show with lots of different kinds of statistical studies that suicide is much more impulsive than we usually think. We think it's the sort of chronic endpoint of an almost biological disease. And that's not what we see. What we see is people are very often have had a loss or humiliation within a few months before. There have been lots of different studies and different ways that we can look at that. So something, I think shame is one of the big things that happens. If a person feels shame, it's very hard to get rid of that. And you can feel shame for things you didn't do, things that happened to you. But yeah, with the terminology, it's certainly one of the things where I prefer. Yeah, I don't think it's mostly the end point of a biological disease, and more people are killed by suicide. More people die by suicide every year in this country than by murder. It's the top third killer of people under around 45, and you know, between like 15 and 45. It's the top, one of the top 10 killers in the country for every age. People who do it the most are older white men. Women try more, but complete less, we think, because of access to guns. More than half of the gun deaths in this country are suicide, and more than half of the suicides in this country are guns. Access to means. I get letters from people saying that they want to hunt, but they keep their gun somewhere else because they know themselves. In the 90s, the UK made it illegal to sell large amounts of acetaminophen. You had to buy them in a bubble pack, only a few at a time. Big deal. So you go to a couple different pharmacies, buy them, and pop them out, right? No. People don't. If there are a couple of steps you have to do in order to kill yourself, you're likely to survive. Because it doesn't stay that intense that long. So get the means out of the house. But we're talking 40,000 Americans every year taking their lives. And that means that some people who don't think that's going to happen to them might need to hear now that when you have that thought, that don't let your worst mood kill all your others. Be on guard. Just be on guard. We all have homicidal thoughts. We don't have to debate, does that mean I should? We know that's wrong. And suicide isn't quite right, and it isn't quite a right. And so if you put that in your head before it happens, lots of different studies show that many people who attempt never attempt again.
Can you relate all of this, religion and doubt, and suicide, and to attachment theory in psychology?
Attachment theory is the basic idea is that you can study usually a mother and her child, and if the if the child expects the mother to meet the needs, they roam farther, they behave differently when they can't see their mother, and psychologists relate that kind of, if you're not well enough attached, later on in life, you do seem to have intimacy problems and some difficulties. So, I mean, these days people believe misery is mostly biological. I think it can become biological, but I think that attachment theory is one of the many ways we talk about whether your body has been sort of rigged up through your childhood to be worried or miserable or tense, to expect to feel those ways. And then sometimes we give the reasons for it. But yeah, one thing I love about the mail I get about this is that it gets people to therapy, and I very much believe in therapy. So I'm not at all trying to replace it, but I am saying, you know, even in schools, we tell people how to see the warning signs in other kids. Because colleges now, it's beating alcohol as a death, and in colleges and in countrywide, it just surpassed auto accidents. It's really on the rise. It was 30,000 a year when we checked in 2000, and then in 2010 it was up to just under 40,000, and then it hit 40,000.
Jennifer, we are out of time, however. Thank you so much, Dr. Jennifer. Thank you.
That was Dr. Jennifer Michael Hecht. Before that, Keith Lowell Jensen, the comedian. Before that, Dave Kong. So that's our podcast for this week. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.